every day on 4CA. John McKenzie, 1300 872 911.
Let's go to these bizarre developments. Basically, we're going to compare the mood yesterday in Afghanistan with what's appearing today in our newspapers. It's almost beyond belief, the transformation in attitude from yesterday to today. Let's go firstly to what is across page 3 of the Courier Mail today. The Taliban joyously fired guns into the air and offered words of reconciliation as they celebrated defeating the United States and returning to power after two decades of war that devastated Afghanistan. The last of 6,000 United States troops who oversaw a desperate evacuation effort flew out of Kabul airport on Monday night, ending the war that has diminished the United States' status as a superpower. Taliban fighters quickly swept into the airport and fired weapons into the sky in jubilation. An astonishing return after United States forces invaded in 2001. And toppled the hardline Islamists for supporting al-Qaeda. Look, of course, these developments beg hundreds of questions, I know, and we won't have time for lots of them. But I do want to get through to a Professor Greg Barton. Greg, in the early stages, or I suppose middle stages of this struggle, has often offered his views on how things were travelling. He's the chair of Global Islamic Politics and Terrorism Expert at Deakin University in Victoria, and he's on the line now. G'day, Greg.
G'day, good to be with you again.
Did you, when we used to speak about developments in Afghan, ever imagine that the whole thing that would see a collapse in fundamentally, what was it, 11 days or something?
No, I certainly didn't think 11 days. I don't think anyone did. I think going back a few months, when the Taliban began to take more than half of the 407 districts and waited outside the provincial capitals, it was pretty clear that things were collapsing fast. But that final 2 weeks where they took all those provincial capitals, and including the national capital, in such a pace was remarkable. Looking back, it was clear that when the US pulled out of Bagram Air Base and took away their air support, but also the 18,000 contracts to get the Afghan aircraft flying and the intelligence support, that things were going to go south pretty quickly. But it was when Ashraf Ghani, the former president, walked out of the presidential palace one Sunday afternoon without any warning to anyone, based apparently on a rumor that he was told that the Taliban were coming for him, that's when that collapse just took off, because the Taliban were waiting outside the city with the president gone. There was no one in charge. So, yeah, it's a strange ending to a very sad and strange war.
Well, it's just absolutely bizarre. I mean, particularly for observers from Western countries to see something like this. I mean, who do you blame? Is it the Americans' fault for having misread so dreadfully the lack of commitment from the Afghan government?
Yeah, look, there's plenty of blame to go around, but just quickly, corrupt, very brittle, very highly centralised government in a country that was much better suited to a federation and was, you know, was modern in the cities but not modern outside the cities. So that centralised government was never going to work. Then just pouring tens of billions of dollars into it at a rapid pace was bound to lead to the sort of corruption we saw. There was an inflated sort of figure for the size of the military. They said 300,000, actually 100,000 on paper were police. But the remaining 200,000, you know, there were probably, I don't know, 150,000 soldiers who were able to fight. Others were sort of ghost soldiers. And even those poor guys who were fighting, many of them on the front lines were not paid.
Really?
In recent months, they weren't getting food and they weren't getting enough bullets to replace what they would shoot. So apart from the 20,000-strong commando group who really fought to the end, the rest of them were persuaded by the Taliban when encircled that, you know, you can either die at our hands or you can walk away and we'll forgive you. So that end of the collapse seems very predictable in hindsight, but it goes back to a long story of delusion and denial and spin and cover-up about Afghanistan. We've been forever telling ourselves, false accounts and believing them because we wanted to believe them. It's wishful thinking at best and lying at worst. It was pretty clear, I think, by most analysts' accounts, people served there, that from around 2009, when the Afghan Taliban had really surged, that this war was unwinnable. it doesn't mean it had to end this way. I think there was a different end that could have been achieved. I think Biden could certainly have managed the transition much better. I think that Trump and Biden were foolish to believe that the so-called peace process was a genuine peace process.
Yeah.
So there were mistakes made there. But an alternative ending probably would have seen a divided Taliban, divided Afghanistan, with maybe the large cities kept out of the Taliban hands. But we'll never know.
In that peace process, clearly the United States chose to believe what was being promised, even though they would have had a strong belief that that wasn't going to be followed through, but it was more comfortable for them. Let me take you to this question, too. It reads here, the Taliban fired their guns into the air, offered words of reconciliation yesterday. These words of reconciliation, it's interesting because you're saying when these Afghan military people were surrounded by the Taliban and they were given the offer, you know, lay down your arms and we'll let you go away. Here's the reconciliation early stages. If you continue to fight on, we'll just kill you. Talk to me about this reconciliation. In those cases, there haven't been reports of them going back on their word. What about now? What are you expecting as far as the commitments of the Taliban are concerned?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because what it goes to the heart of is what's motivating the Taliban. We know that they're terribly brutal and kill without compunction and are unafraid to die themselves. So why would they show restraint? And I think it's because this project of forming a so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, they fought for 20 years to win this project back that they had started in the 1990s. And I think that's everything to them. They want this alternative state to work, so they're prepared to compromise and play the long game, which we're always focused on winning battles and losing a war. Mm. So it did make sense to try and generate a kind of morale collapse, a psychological collapse in their military campaign, and letting people walk away was part of that. Now they desperately need international finance. They're not going to get as much as the previous government, obviously, but there's $9 billion in national financial reserves locked up in a bank in New York, and they may have a chance of getting some of that back. China, I think, will give them some financial support. They need that because the previous government got two-thirds, three-quarters of their operating budget from international aid. Mm. Afghanistan is a country of 38 million. It's almost doubled since the Taliban were last in power. Most people under the age of 19, so young and very poor, are half on the edge of really bad poverty.
Yes.
So from a humanitarian concern, we sort of want to try and make this thing work now. Mm. So there is, oddly enough, common interest. We are not happy the Taliban are won, but we want them to have leverage on them to show restraint, and we want them to try and do a halfway decent job of providing food. We have no other options. They've won militarily, so it's this leverage which is all important.
This is so much about posturing from what you're saying, but I need to ask you this because the world is concerned about, well, the status of women under the Taliban. This is one of the most worrying aspects of the whole change of power, well, yesterday, fundamentally. What are your beliefs about their intentions as far as the status of women is concerned?
Well, they'd like us to believe that Taliban 2.0 is a changed beast. I don't believe that that's the case. I think that they clearly are engaging with communications and public relations much better than they ever did in the past. And social media, of course, has swept Afghanistan as it has the world. Most people in Afghanistan have access to a smartphone, so that's changed. Education's changed the cities too, and girls and women have been educated, so they're dealing with a different population. Whilst I don't think the Taliban have changed deep down, I think there's reason, as I outlined before, to hope that their leaders will see virtue in restraint, not because they're reformed characters, but because they need to make this state project work. Mm. And I think, to be fair, most of the Taliban fighters would be kids, literally, you know, teenagers and early 20s, who have grown up since the last the Taliban were in power. Many of them would never have been in a big city as Kabul, a city of 5 million, is now. So there's the possibility that if the leaders hold things together and say we're going to do this because this is what our mission is, some of these young fighters might be changed. But the danger, of course, is, you know, now that the international forces have gone, international television cameras are slowly going away, that brutality will come back. And there's lots of accounts of the brutality already coming back, which leads to one last thing, and that is that negotiating with the Taliban now gives half a chance that some of the people who didn't make that remarkable airlift of the last fortnight might still be allowed to fly out commercially. And I know it's a slender hope, but it's worth fighting for.
Yeah, that keeps coming up again and again. Don't go away. How on earth does a country double its population in 20 years? You just said they're 38 million in population now since the war began. It's doubled. How does that happen?
Partly because we think of a war as 20 years long, but for the people of Afghanistan, it's 44 years long.
Oh, okay.
So there were decades of civil war, really atrocious war, before the invasion and the toppling of the Taliban regime. So they were coming out of nothing, off a very low base. And basic services were put in place, you know, clean water and sewerage systems and basic food. That makes a big difference. And basic medicines, you know, you can turn around infant mortality and maternal morbidity quite quickly to do some basic things, and that was done. I mean, there was a lot of good work done in Afghanistan, it has to be said. It's not all hopeless, even though the government project was hopeless and the military side was poorly planned.
Now, this is a mystery to me. Let's face it. Our country was in a state of war, hostility with Afghanistan officially. And I pick up the Courier Mail today, the first day of the peace, if you like. And here's the headline in the Courier Mail today. Taliban is up for tour. The Taliban has indicated approval for the Afghanistan men's cricket team to travel to Australia for an historic test match in November. This is 5 minutes away. SBS confirmed with a member of the Taliban that there's no specific objection to the men's side travelling to Australia for the game due to start November 27 in Hobart. The deputy head of the Taliban's Cultural Commission, Abdullah Wasik, told SBS that all previously organised matches will continue without interruption and the Afghan team can play with other international teams. Can you believe this? I mean, this is the first day of the peace, Greg Barton, and we're having a cricket test with them.
Well, we're not talking about the guys with the turbans and the bushy beards and baggy clothes, turning up at the pitch. Well, I think we're talking about Afghan sportsmen and women,
yes,
who had previously sort of really pushed ahead. I mean, the Afghan cricket team previously had gone ahead in leaps and bounds.
Yes.
And so here's the public relations spin from the Taliban saying, we'll allow them to get back to doing what they're doing before.
Yes.
Now, obviously I'm sceptical of that, but at the same time, as I've been arguing, we have no leverage over them. They've won the war. We've got to try and do everything we can, because most of those 38 million will never get a chance to leave Afghanistan. Mm. We've got to try and put pressure on this new government to make their lives reasonable. And one of the bits of leverage we have is international recognition. We've got to be really careful about this, but saying, yes, we'll take the Afghan, presumably men's cricket team,
yes,
but standing up for other Afghan athletes is something that could do some good. And if this seems kind of pie in the sky, think about this airlift. You know, in 2 weeks, more than 120,000 people lifted out. There were some tragic incidents, it's true, but that was, historical achievement, and it was done largely peacefully, and that was because of, believe it or not, cooperation between the Afghan forces outside the airport perimeter and international forces inside. So that was something that was worth achieving for all of the mistakes made.
Yeah, still takes your breath away, doesn't it? Look, it's a most bizarre, steep learning curve for all of us. Greg, this has been fascinating as always. Thank you.
A pleasure. I mean, I think the takeaway here is we shouldn't give up on Afghanistan. We shouldn't forget. There's a long way to go yet.
We'll stay in touch. Good on you, Greg. He's the chair of Global Islamic Politics, and he's a terrorism expert at Deakin University in Victoria. It's 6 to 10.
Each day.